Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Larry Levitt, Executive Vice President at the Kaiser Family Foundation. He's taken a deep dive into what Medicare for All actually means. He breaks down the various health reform proposals being talked about on the campaign trail and talks about the shift in the role of insurance companies should any of them come to fruition. Roy Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with the Kaiser Family Foundation's Larry Levitt here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Larry Levitt, Executive Vice President for Health Policy at Kaiser Family Foundation. He previously served as Editor-in-Chief at KaiserNetwork.org, the foundation's online health policy news and information service. Prior to his time at the foundation, he was the senior health policy advisor to the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services under President Clinton. He holds a bachelor's degree in economics from UC Berkeley and a master's in public policy from Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Larry, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, it's been 7 years, so we're glad you're still in the throes of this, and we are in the throes of this presidential election with a very crowded field. I think crowded is an understatement. Crowded is like seven people in a Volkswagen bus. This is way beyond that, and you know, it seems that the Affordable Care Act, while it remains the law of the land, there's sort of a drumbeat of challenges. You've got United States versus Texas on the right challenging it. And on the left, you have what appears to be a whole group of people. I don't know if they're abandoning the Affordable Care Act, but they're moving on to a new iteration of health reform, namely some form of universal coverage or Medicare for All. And I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand the sort of nuanced difference between Medicare for All, single payer, universal coverage, and maybe put this in some historical context for us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been having this debate for well over 50 years, you know, certainly dating back to President Harry Truman, who proposed the first formal national health insurance plan. And the basic contours of this idea of national health insurance or a single-payer health plan or Medicare for All has been around since then. The terminology has changed so much, somewhat. We used to call it single-payer or a national health insurance plan. Now, I think kind of latching on to the popularity of the Medicare program is this idea of calling it Medicare for All. But the idea is still basically the same. The idea that everyone is covered automatically, that the government is sponsoring health insurance. The government is not employing doctors or owning hospitals, so it's not socialized medicine, but the government is serving as the insurer for everyone, not just for seniors, not just for low-income people, like in Medicaid or Medicare today. And again, everyone is automatically covered by virtue of being a resident of the United States.
Well, Larry, given some of the impassioned speeches we've heard during the debates and in between them, there are some variations even among the candidates in what they really mean by Medicare for All. And I agree with you. I've never heard Medicare spoken of with so much love and affection as we have in this current season, in this, I guess, 50th anniversary, yeah, right, of the passage of the act. So Bernie Sanders generally is considered to be the most radically sort of far out there on the Medicare for All. And Elizabeth Warren's pretty closely aligned with this idea that you've got to take the insurance companies out of the equation, except for the U.S. being the insurance company through Medicare. But on a practical basis, based on all your years of policy, how would that work in this country to really take the private insurance industry out of the equation altogether? What sort of follows from that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at one level, it's very simple that everyone gets a Medicare card and everyone gets access to health care automatically with no deductibles, no copays, no premiums. At a practical level, it's really much more complicated mm-hmm. than that. You know, other countries, every other high-income country has universal coverage. The United States stands out as the exception, as the only country that does not cover everyone. But the idea of Medicare for All, as put forward by Senator Sanders or Senator Warren, in some ways would leapfrog all these other countries by eliminating private insurance, eliminating premiums and deductibles and copays entirely. You know, all these other countries that have universal coverage still preserve some role for private insurance, whether right. it's to supplement the benefits, which don't cover everything in these other countries, or to allow people to jump the queue to get access to care more quickly or see a certain, you know, other doctors or hospitals. So what Senator Sanders is proposing is really a much more expansive version of universal coverage than we see in any other country. It would certainly be simpler. It would certainly have lower administrative costs and profits. But the idea of eliminating an industry that, you know, is employs tens of thousands of people and that is, you know, very profitable and very powerful, not only poses kind of difficult practical issues, but also difficult political challenges mm-hmm. as well.
You know, Larry, obviously there are some variations on the theme of Medicare for All. Senator Kamala Harris has her own version of this. It obviously differs in some really significant ways, including a 10-year transition period, which she was apparently roundly criticized in the last debate. Why would it take that long? But some have observed that it doesn't seem to properly bring the country towards universal coverage. Maybe you could dissect her plan a little for us and tell us what's unique about her initiative here.
Yeah, I think what Senator Kamala Harris is proposing is a plan that tries to capture the improved access to care and insurance that Medicare for All would bring, but without some of the political landmines involved. So really kind of two big differences in Senator Harris's plan. One is the 10-year transition, as you mentioned. You know, 10 years is a long time, but I think what Senator Harris is putting forward is that, you know, people wouldn't have to wait 10 years. They would immediately get access to Medicare on an optional basis mm-hmm. or voluntary basis. And it would really allow people to kind of see what this Medicare for All plan would look like before being required to join it. So it relieves some of that anxiety that people would have at being, you know, forced to join a government insurance plan. And then the second is, you know, keeping private insurers in the mix. Currently in Medicare today, about a third of beneficiaries have a private insurance plan. They're called Medicare Advantage plans. And what Senator Harris would do is keep those Medicare Advantage plans as part of Medicare. So it would allow the private insurance industry to compete with the government plan and give people the choice.
Well, Larry, I really appreciate your hanging in with us on this issue of the positions because it's so important for people to understand them. So we've talked about a few people, but maybe think about what Vice President Joe Biden has been saying. He's pretty emphatic that he wants to see the Affordable Care Act improved upon and strengthened, something I think we thought would have happened over these many years since it was first passed back when we probably first spoke with you, but that didn't happen for a lot of reasons. But some people say that doesn't really address the cost of healthcare, and that will still remain a problem. And, of course, we still see some people who are uninsured. Others like Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, who authored Medicare X in Congress, are calling for a similar approach. What's the hallmark of these more moderate proposals, in your view?
Yeah, I mean, these proposals are being called moderate, but they go way further than anyone mm-hmm. could have imagined when the Affordable Care Act was passed over 9 years ago. And these proposals have a few things in common. One is they build on the Affordable Care Act by filling in some of the big holes that still exist mm-hmm. in the ACA. One of those is affordability for middle-class people. Middle-class people who buy their own insurance, you know, small business owners, self-employed people, farmers, early retirees aren't eligible for any subsidies, any help under the Affordable Care Act, and they've been feeling the brunt of big premium increases, really taking it on the chin. These proposals would expand the subsidies to these middle-class people whose incomes are more than four times the poverty level. The second thing they would do is fill in what's called the Medicaid coverage gap. you know, when the Supreme Court decided that the Medicaid expansion as part of the ACA was optional for states, a number of states still have not taken up the expansion, particularly mm-hmm. states in the South. And Vice President Biden's plan would extend coverage to poor people in those states who don't have access to anything today. And then the final is this idea of a public option. So trying to capture the cost containment promise of Medicare for all, the simplification, but making it voluntary for people. Mm-hmm. So giving people the option of joining Medicare, but not necessarily requiring or making it mandatory for everyone.
We're speaking today with Larry Leavitt, Executive Vice President for Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. He previously served as Editor-in-Chief at KaiserNetwork.org, the foundation's online health policy news and information service. You know, Larry, lots of conversations about the cost of healthcare, and there's another side that doesn't get discussed as much, that obviously this is an enormous part of our economy, up to 20% of our GDP. So on one hand, you have people who are talking about the efficiencies that currently exist in the Medicare program in mm-hmm. terms of administrative mm-hmm. costs, that we could lower those. Others are talking about a larger expenditure, maybe financing some of the additional expansion, certainly covering prescriptions, dental care, mm-hmm. and some other elements that aren't currently in the Medicare plan. I'm wondering what kind of impact to the GDP would be felt, and I know you've done some work on this, if health companies were taken out of the equation. Would we be willing, if we got the results that they get in Western Europe in terms of outcomes, pay what we're paying now? Would we see a benefit to our society? Because what we're seeing in the European countries, what appears to be better outcomes at a reduced cost, I still don't believe that you can really reduce cost with the health industrial complex without a huge struggle.
Yeah, well, you know, you hear a lot that Medicare for all, that we can't afford Medicare for all. And, you know, I think that confuses a lot of definitions of affordability and cost. You know, certainly Medicare for all would result in much higher government expenditures for healthcare. I mean, that's a feature, not a bug, of Medicare for all. The idea mm-hmm. is to eliminate deductibles, eliminate copays, eliminate premiums, but you still have to pay for healthcare. And the way we would pay for it is through taxes. So it would be a shift from paying through premiums and deductibles to paying for it through taxes. So certainly government spending on healthcare would go up dramatically, but what people spend out of their own pockets and what employers spend would go down a lot. Now, whether we as a nation can afford that is really more a question of how overall health spending, regardless of where it comes from, changes under Medicare for All. And, you know, that depends on the details. You know, Medicare for All would pay doctors and hospitals and drug companies less, and that would save money. We'd see administrative efficiencies from not having insurance companies in the mix. You know, Medicare now administers, you know, costs about 3% overhead to administer Medicare compared to upwards of 10% for private insurance. So that would all help to reduce healthcare spending. On the other hand, we would have universal coverage. So the 10% of our population that doesn't have any health insurance now would have coverage and they would use more healthcare. That's the point of giving people health insurance. And eliminating deductibles and copays would lead people to use more healthcare, and that would boost health spending as well. Most of the estimates suggest that, you know, if Medicare for All were implemented like it exists on paper in Senator Sanders' bill, we would spend about the same as we do now on healthcare as a country. So you can't really say that we can't afford it. We would just be paying for it very differently. Now, what result would that have on the economy, on outcomes? You know, we spend double what the average other high-income country spends on healthcare. We will not in my lifetime, I think, get down to the level that other countries are spending on healthcare, but we can certainly deliver care more efficiently. These other countries spend half of what we do, and they get better outcomes, longer life expectancy, you know, better health, lower mortality due to amenable to healthcare. You know, some of that's due to I think a better organized health system, you know, more, greater emphasis on primary care. But frankly, some of it's due to things these other countries do outside of the healthcare system.
Right.
You know, while we spend so much more than the rest of the world on healthcare, they spend a lot more than us on social services, you know, things like housing,
right,
and social supports. And if we could take some of that healthcare spending and shift it to social spending, then I think we could probably get better health out of it. But you know, that's a lot easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Larry, one of the great services provided by the Kaiser Family Foundation, which we really appreciate, is regular polling of the American public on a whole variety of aspects of health policy. And this point has been made by a number of people on those debate stages that the polls have shown pretty consistently that those with health coverage through their employers are really pretty darn satisfied with their coverage and with their health care, even though I think there is genuine concern and worry about the fact that co-pays and high deductibles are chipping away somewhat at that satisfaction. What's your sense of how consumers feel generally about the possibility of a public option or a single payer system, given what those polls have been showing over recent years? How does your data show that trending at this point as this becomes such a front and center topic in the debates?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like people love their health insurance. I mean, you don't get into dinner conversations with people, you know, raving about their amazing insurance company. But generally, people give their health insurance pretty good grades. But you know, as you said, there are a lot of problems. Deductibles have tripled in the last decade, while wages have risen hardly at all. You know, 40% of people we survey with employer-based insurance say they or someone in their family has had some kind of problem affording healthcare in the last year. So people are not in love with their private insurance, but they are very anxious about the idea of losing it. You know, when we ask people, do you support Medicare for All? Majority of people do support Medicare for All. But there's a lot of confusion about what that mm-hmm. means. Hopefully mm-hmm. the show will help alleviate some of that confusion. But for example, most people who support Medicare for All believe that they will be able to keep their current health insurance, which is not the case. You know, people, if we present people with the idea that, you know, private health insurance would be eliminated, or the government would get more involved in healthcare, or there might be longer waits for services, the kind of messages that opponents will use in this debate, support plummets, mm-hmm. in effect, support shifts to opposition. The idea of a public option gets significantly more support. You know, we as Americans don't like to be told what to do. Mm-hmm. Giving people the option of joining Medicare sounds mm-hmm. a lot better than requiring them to join Medicare and give up their current health insurance. And I think that's why you're seeing some of these ideas, like from the transition that Senator Harris laid out, or what Vice President Biden has proposed, gain some traction, because it eliminates some of the anxiety and some of the political right. downsides of Medicare for All.
Speaking of sort of the political downsides, I just wonder, after all the rhetoric the elections had, if the Democrats win, what do your polls show about what they should do? And I'm sort of thinking about the struggle that President Obama had. He got through the Affordable Care Act, but lost the Congress. You've got issues about transportation, income inequality. You think it's worth, you know, the squeeze is worth the juice in terms of sustaining this? We have not been able to do it with Affordable Care Act what we're able to do with Medicaid and Medicare. A good bill, but not a perfect bill, that over a number of years, mm-hmm. we made important changes that strengthened
and still do. Yeah.
The Affordable Care Act, we've never really been able to make the types of changes that would have improved an imperfect bill, which everyone knew it was imperfect. I'm just wondering about the political calculus and where the public might be as you sort of think about past the election, past everything that people say, where's the right focal point for the government?
Yeah, well, you know, our polling is very consistent. First, that healthcare is a top issue for voters. And second, when they say healthcare is a top issue, they mean reducing the cost of healthcare and making it more affordable. That's what Americans want. I mean, that's the filter they are viewing this debate through. Now, you know, advocates of Medicare for All can certainly make the case that healthcare would be more affordable for many people and costs would come down. But all these proposals have trade-offs. You know, at the bumper sticker level, healthcare reform ideas sound great. Once you start filling in the details and the trade-offs become clear and it becomes apparent that there are losers as well as winners, then they become quite controversial. You know, and we saw that with the Affordable Care Act. I mean, the Affordable Care Act was very popular at first, and then as time went by, it became less popular. And frankly, the only thing that made the Affordable Care Act popular once again was Republican efforts to repeal it, which in and of itself was very unpopular. You know, so in a campaign, candidates promising to lower healthcare costs and make care more affordable for people, you know, those ideas will really resonate with voters. Actually putting forward a big complex bill that will have losers as well as winners is probably not going to be a political winner for any incoming president. I mean, that's been the history that healthcare reform at the talking point level is very attractive politically, you know, the political capital necessary to get a bill passed, you know, tends to hurt presidents.
We've been speaking today with Larry Levitt, the Executive Vice President for Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. You can learn more about their very important work by going to kff.org or follow them on Twitter at KaiserFamFound or at Larry Levitt. That's L-E-V-I-T-T. Larry, we want to thank you so much for your work, your dedication to keeping us informed about health policy, and for joining us again on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we really appreciate your time.
Yep, really appreciate all your work. You're one of our sources of truth.
That's right.
Oh, thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
In the latest Democratic presidential debate, Senator Kamala Harris of California and former Vice President Joe Biden disagreed on aspects of their health care plan. Biden initially said that his health care plan would cover the, quote, vast majority of Americans. But when pushed by Harris, he later said it would cover everyone. His own campaign website says otherwise. Biden's plan calls for, among other things, offering a Medicare-style public health insurance option as a choice and increasing tax credits for individuals purchasing insurance on the Affordable Care Act's exchanges. His website says his plan to build on the ACA will, quote, insure more than an estimated 97% of Americans. Harris said as many as 10 million people wouldn't be covered under Biden's plan. Her campaign told us she gets to that number by calculating 3% of the currently estimated U.S. population. That works out to 9.88 million people. However, that figure includes more than just Americans, as Biden's campaign website said, because not everyone living in the U.S. is a citizen. It's worth noting that Biden's campaign has reportedly said that under his plan, immigrants living in the U.S. illegally would be able to purchase insurance through the ACA exchanges, which is not currently allowed. Those immigrants still wouldn't be eligible for federal subsidies, his campaign explained. Biden said that Harris's plan, quote, will require middle-class taxes to go up, not down. Harris has proposed her own version of a Medicare for All plan that features an expanded Medicare system, including private insurers, and is phased in over a 10-year period. But in a July 29 Medium post, Harris said her plan to pay for her proposal will, quote, exempt households making below $100,000, along with a higher income threshold for middle-class families living in high-cost areas. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, Managing Editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's estimated that a majority of a person's lifelong health expenditures are often spent in the final months of life. But death is one of those topics that generates the least amount of conversation in the clinical setting in American healthcare. For folks who end up critically ill or facing a terminal diagnosis like late-stage cancer, this can often lead to poorly communicated end-of-life wishes being discussed with the clinician, who then often resorts to extreme interventions.
In oncology, you know, notoriously, we are underprepared to have these conversations with patients. There's a desire to want to provide patients with truth. However, there's this unspoken misconception that by having honest conversations about prognosis, that we are somehow removing the hope that patients are coming to us looking for. And actually, most studies that have evaluated this have shown that when you provide honest prognostic information to patients and allow patients to be part of the decision making about their goals of care, regardless of how close they may be to the end of life, they are more appreciative of it and actually have more understanding of their disease process and better satisfaction with their care overall.
Dr. Manali Patel is a clinical researcher at Stanford University School of Medicine. He sought to find interventions that might give clinicians and families a more useful tool to address this gap in communication. Her earlier research at Stanford had yielded an interesting finding. Late-stage cancer patients felt more comfortable talking about end-of-life issues with a layperson as opposed to a clinician. Patel set up a study to examine that finding further. She and her fellow researchers followed patients at the Veterans Administration Palo Alto Healthcare System for 15 months after they were diagnosed with stage 3 or 4 or recurrent cancer. Half the people were randomly assigned to speak with a lay worker about the goals of care over a 6-month period. The control group was given no such intervention, and the lay workers were given a rigorous 80-hour course and clinical observations before being assigned to the study.
What we found during the intervention was that she learned as she went, and as the project went through the cycles of starting the implementation and then ramping up and then at the end, she was completely proficient with having these conversations such that she came to that realization that these conversations really are not scary and shouldn't be scary and shouldn't be medicalized. And maybe she didn't need all that training to begin with. We had hired her specifically because of her service orientation and because she had a very supportive ear. And that's really the main crux of this intervention, was finding the right person who can engage in these conversations without needing a lot of training to do so.
92% of the participants who received the layperson intervention, compared to only 18% of the control group, were likely to have end-of-life directives in their electronic health record and more likely to have communicated their wishes to their clinicians as well, often choosing hospice over emergency room interventions as their conditions deteriorated. The health costs of both groups varied as well. The average cost of care for the intervention group in the last month of life was about $1,000 versus $23,000 for the control group. Dr. Patel said one of the more interesting findings was much higher patient satisfaction among those who'd received the intervention.
We found that the satisfaction scores went up for the patients in the intervention arm, but they went down for patients in the control arm, as well as the satisfaction with decision making across all 6 scores of the satisfaction with decision scale. We found overwhelmingly that the patients in the intervention arm were very satisfied with the decisions that they had made regarding their medical treatments and regarding their life, but the patients in the control arm really did not have much movement at all in terms of how satisfied they were at the beginning of the cancer diagnosis.
The results are published in this month's JAMA Oncology, a low-resource, compassionate, patient-centered intervention that assists terminally ill patients, their families, and their clinicians to have a frank discussion about end-of-life wishes, improving patient satisfaction at such a sensitive and challenging time, and saving significant costs as well. That's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.